From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Pope Francis's apostolic exhortation, Amoris Laetitia, is 2 years old, and despite it being on a subject of monumental importance today, marriage and family life, the document remains both polarizing and controversial. We talked to prominent moral theologian Dr. John Grabowski about its impact and legacy. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio, and I'm joined by my co-host Matthew Bunsen, who is a Register senior editor. Matthew, welcome.
Oh, great to be with you, as always.
So, Matthew, before we talk to Dr. Grabowski, let's focus on your analysis of the way bishops and national bishops' conferences have interpreted Amoris Laetitia over the last 2 years. Your piece is entitled Amoris Laetitia Remains Amorphous. What do you mean by that title?
Well, someone actually proposed that the title should be Amorphous Laetitia.
That's right.
Basically, what we're realizing as the 2 years have passed, as we're looking at the second anniversary, is that the bishops are very divided about its implementation. Now, let's state at the outset that there is a surprisingly limited number of bishops and episcopal conferences who have actually implemented their own plans or even pastoral guidelines for Amoris.
That's so funny that you even say that. Let me stop you, because one of the things that struck me about your report is that you were able to cover what bishops around the world have done on Amoris Laetitia in 1,500 words.
Right. You would expect that by now, 2 years in, that there would be dozens and dozens of Episcopal conferences and hundreds of bishops who have weighed in on this. And yet, there seems to be this decision to maintain a certain prudential silence or simply to see how this is all shaking out in the church. But that itself tells us something. You noted in the introduction that this is a controversial and a rather polarizing document. So we're seeing almost two distinctive worldviews in how we're interpreting at least certain parts of Amoris Laetitia. And of course, when we say certain parts, we mean chapter 8.
Right. That's right. And of course, chapter 8 deals with communion for the divorced and civilly remarried, and that's where all the discussion has been.
Well, it's funny too about chapter 8, because even that, the discussion of communion for the divorced and civilly remarried Catholics, is just the tiniest of slivers in chapter 8.
It's a footnote.
It's a footnote. Yes, exactly.
Right. It's a footnote.
Whereas the rest of chapter 8 is dedicated to the keys that Pope Francis sees of accompaniment, of discernment, of helping people who are in difficult and irregular situations beyond just those who might find themselves to be divorced and civilly remarried.
So let's talk for a minute about your report, your analysis, which is a really great read in 1,500 words. It's a great summary, I think, of what has happened over the last 2 years. And really, at first, you point out the bishops who have said something. So what have bishops, and this is really in the United States that we're looking at in this first part, what have the bishops of the United States, individual bishops, said?
Well, it really begins, so many things do today, with Archbishop Charles Chaput of Philadelphia, who understood immediately the significance of Amoris Laetitia, but also the importance of providing very clear guidelines, not just to his faithful, but to the priests of his archdiocese, and giving them direction in what was that immediately confusing time after the implementation and promulgation of this apostolic exhortation. So he makes very clear that he is acting, as he puts it, in fidelity to the Holy Father by doing the work that, as he writes so beautifully, we were ordained to do as bishops, he says.
Right.
And that means issuing guidelines or pastoral plans that make clear, once again, that the teachings of the church have not changed here, and that we have an obligation to the faithful to help them live the truth. Now, that stands in sharp contrast to the directives issued by Bishop McElroy, Bishop Robert McElroy of San Diego, who also issued something in the immediate aftermath of the promulgation of Amoris Laetitia. It's called Embracing the Joy of Love. And in that, he talks about the role of accompaniment and informing the conscience of the discerner and principles of Catholic faith, as he writes. And he concludes that there are some Catholics who are going to engage in a process of discernment, who will conclude that God, as he puts it, is calling them to return to full participation in the life of the Church and the Eucharist. So right at the start from this discussion, we've had two very different worldviews on how we're going to go about implementing
this. Sure, you see continuity and then you see discontinuity. And but let's remark on a few of the others who have been in continuity. We have Bishop James Conley of Lincoln, Nebraska, Bishop Thomas Olmsted of Phoenix, Arizona, Bishop Stephen Lopes of the Anglican Ordinariate of the Chair of St. Peter. All of them did similar things to what Archbishop Chappie did. And of course, Cardinal Wuerl tried to open this up and include a conversation in his pastoral letter about more than just Chapter 8 and the guidelines for divorced and remarried Catholics. And hopefully many other bishops will follow suit. We now have a guest who is from the Archdiocese of Washington, where Cardinal Wuerl is. And Dr. John Grabowski of the Catholic University of America, he is a moral theologian, is joining us now. Dr. Grabowski, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be with you today.
So you recently wrote a piece for the Register, a commentary that we requested on the significance and legacy of Amoris Laetitia. Thank you for doing that. It's a great piece, and we're delighted to have it. Your piece is titled, There's a Lot to Like in Amoris Laetitia. And given the controversy, this might surprise some people. So, first of all, what do you mean by your title?
Well, first of all, let's state the obvious. There's a lot in Amoris Laetitia, right? It's a huge document. It's about three times the size of Pope St. John Paul II's exhortation on Family Familiars Consortio. So it's massive, but I think what's tended to happen in the discussion of the document is everyone has fixated on a certain part, particularly Chapter 8, mm-hmm. which Pope Francis said would be challenging to everyone. I think those words have proven mm-hmm. prophetic. And they've lost sight of much of what else is in the rest of the document. And there is a lot of beautiful, important teaching, exhortation, direction given to the whole church and its ministry for families in the rest of the document. So I think we need to attend to the whole document and the message of the document as a whole and not simply get lost in the discussion of how do we read Chapter 8.
Sure. So, you know, in the beginning of your commentary, you talk about this document coming out of a synod, right? And so did Pope John Paul's document in 1981, Familiaris Consortio. And these documents are drawing upon the act of listening. And you say that you actually saw Pope Francis listening. So you attended a part of the synods?
I was at the 2015 synod. I was appointed quite unexpectedly for me to serve as an expert there. So I was there for all 3 weeks of the synod and took part. I was not at the 2014 extraordinary synod, but so yeah, I did get to see Pope Francis up close in the General Assembly sessions, and he really did, as he tells us in the document, listen. Mm-hmm. And so the document, and part of this is reflected in its size, is the fruit of that very intensive listening on the part of the Holy Father.
As well, and you make this point, as well as his discernment. And as a Jesuit, you know, Pope Francis being a Jesuit, I wanted to ask you, how do you think that has affected his discernment as he wrote this exhortation and has given it to the Church?
I think two words that characterize Pope Francis's own understanding of his ministry as Pope are synodality and discernment. Mm-hmm. By synodality, he says he means the whole church walking together, listening to the Lord together, bishops, priests, laity, so he sees the synod process very much at the heart of the life of the church, and he sees his own role as, if you will, kind of the discerner in chief, with his brother bishops discerning what the needs of the church are, how best to respond to them. But he emphasized to us at the synod that the discernment that takes place in a synod is always cum Petro et sub Petro. It's with Peter and under Peter. So this is very much his vision of his own ministry and how he exercises his ministry within the church. And you're right, he's drawing on his own formation as a Jesuit in doing so.
So one of the things, getting back to the what you've said, you know, let's focus on the rest of the document, not Chapter 8. The rest of the document...
Or not just Chapter 8.
Not just Chapter 8, okay. So the rest of the document, why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Because a lot of people don't really realize what's there. And as I said in my intro today to this show... This is timely. We have so many problems with marriage and family. That's why we had a synod to begin with. And so what was the Holy Father really trying to accomplish? And how did, oh my gosh, did we get so stuck on Chapter 8?
Well, I think he tells us his overall purpose a number of times in the document is to present the fullness of what the church teaches, its beauty, its clarity, and its vision of marriage and family and how that's an integral part of God's plan for salvation history, God's plan for the church. He also says quite clearly what he is trying to do in Amoris Laetitia is to not change the church's teaching, to not change doctrine like the indissolubility of marriage, but to change the tone in which people hear the church propose the doctrine. So that people can hear it as an invitation to mercy, as an invitation to healing. At one point, he speaks about there are people who would take the church's doctrine and turn it into stones to hurl at other people. And the image, of course, is that of the woman caught in adultery in Chapter 8 of John's Gospel. Pope Francis doesn't think the church's teaching is meant to be weaponized. It's meant to be an invitation to encounter Christ, who is the Father's mercy. So...
What do you mean by that? That's not weaponized. What do you mean by that? Not it should not be weaponized.
So, again, this is his language. At one point he says, this is in 49, rather than offering the healing power of grace and the light of the gospel message, some would indoctrinate that message, turning it into dead stones to be hurled at others. So in other words, hurl church document at others, to beat them up, to judge them, to cow them into a particular way of thinking, rather than seeing that, no, this doctrine is meant to be an invitation to mercy, an invitation to life, ultimately really an invitation to encounter the person of Christ. And so what he sees a pressing need of the church is to be able to propose her perennial teaching in that way that it can be heard as beautiful, attractive, and an invitation to mercy.
When we come back, we'll continue the discussion with Dr. John Grabowski on his commentary, There's a Lot to Like in Amoris Laetitia. More when we return.
Father Wade Menezes talks about the National Catholic Register.
As the National Catholic Register celebrates its 90th anniversary, I think that says a lot about the publication. It works. It's solidly Catholic. It presents the teachings of the Church, unabashedly so, and also guides its readers to be even more solidly Catholic themselves. One of the major effects that I think the Register has on its readers is that it elevates the intellect. Whether it be a faith item or a news item, it presents the news and the faith item in a very balanced way. One thing that the Register can never be accused of is being too far left or too far right. It is solidly Catholic, right in line with the Chair of Peter. And I think that says a lot about the Register.
For a 6-issue free trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy some of our online content.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and I'm joined by my co-host, Matthew Bunsen, who is a Register Senior Editor.
And we're continuing our conversation with Dr. John Grabowski, a moral theologian from the Catholic University of America. Dr. Grabowski, I'd like to turn now to Chapter 4 of Amoris Laetitia, which a number of theologians and commentators have noted one of the most exquisite parts of Amoris Laetitia. And, of course, we're talking about Pope Francis's meditation on 1 Corinthians. What struck you most about that as somebody who tries to apply the importance of Scripture to moral theology?
What struck me most of it, I think, was really the whole of it. It was stunning because Pope Francis had given almost a year-long catechesis on the family, and there was no hint of that in that catechesis. There was no hint of this at the synod, at least the 2015 synod. So it was like, out of the blue, we get this beautiful, rich, meditative unpacking of St. Paul's hymn to love, which I don't know about you, but for me, you go to a wedding, you expect that to be the second reading at the wedding, and you kind of go on autopilot, love is patient, love is kind. Okay.
And you kind of roll your eyes, too, at the, yeah.
Exactly. And suddenly, it's Pope Francis breaks open the depth of this passage and invites us in and helps us see, no, this is the very essence of the Christian life, to be able to love, to be able to encourage others, to let go of resentments, to not be boastful or proud or airy, to do this is what we're called to as families, as religious, as lay people, as single people. This is the very essence of what we're, and so it's stunning in its beauty, its depth, and it really shows a side of Pope Francis as a theologian and an exegete that I don't think we had really seen before. At least I hadn't.
Is it also that point, that chapter, which causes you to say in your commentary that the theology of the body is alive and well in Pope Francis's ministry and vision for the church? That's your words from the commentaries. Is it chapter 4 that leads you to that statement, and how so?
Well, sure, it's chapter 4, but it's not just, because there is a very, I think there's a deep and a repeated engagement of the theology of the body in Amoris Laetitia. I remember after reading through the document for the first time talking to another theologian who said, yeah, theology of the body, it's just that one little section on erotic love in 150 to 152, and my response was, my goodness, what document did you read? Because that's not the one I read. Because I found it all, I mean, if you bother to read the notes and the quotes, he's engaging St. John Paul II again and again and again when he talks about mutual submission in marriage and how that bears upon a couple's sexual relationship, the relationship between marriage and virginity, the treatment of motherhood, the way in which the liturgical language of a couple's vows become the language, a prophetic description of the whole of their life together, the role of the theology of the body and chastity education. It runs like a thread through not just parts of chapter 4, but into the later discussions as well, in chapter 5 and beyond. So a burning question that I heard posed by many bishops at the synod was, what's happened to the theology of the body? We don't talk about it. We don't hear about it. And it's such a wonderful tool. I think Pope Francis answers the question for us, right? Mm-hmm. The theology of the body, he sees it as a wonderful tool for the new evangelization as well. At least taking him at his own word, that's how he treats it in this document. And so again, that's part of what I mean, but there's a lot to like in this document. There's so much more here than just chapter 8.
So let's talk for a minute about chapter 8. We're nearing the end of this segment, but of course we have to. I mean, the Register has spent a lot of time talking about this. We have given space in our pages and on these airwaves to people who are very critical and are concerned over what is happening. There definitely is a polarization. What is happening here from your perspective? Why is there, from your view, a disconnect, it seems, from the whole of the document?
I read chapter 8 in light of what Pope Francis tells us earlier in the document. He sees this as a way to change the tone and not the teaching. Mm-hmm. And what he does is he goes into some kind of classic distinctions from Catholic casuistry, most of which were developed in the 17th and 18th century by Jesuit moralists, to try to give more space and a less judgmental tone to engage people who are in irregular marital or sexual relationships with others.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the overall purpose. I wish he would have kind of followed through on the virtue-based language of mercy and love that's earlier in the document instead of switching to casuistry.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think he's drawing from his own training and tradition here. But he does say in Chapter 8, there's no changes to the church's doctrine on the indissolubility of marriage. There's no general change to sacramental practice or to canon law other than the reforms of the annulment procedure that he already made. I think at most, the document may walk back a presumption that was put forward by the Pontifical Council for Legislative Texts in a 2000 document, which just stated a general presumption against, including in sacramental participation, anyone who is in a second civil marriage. Pope Francis seems to my reading, open the door to people who are in a canon lawyers call a conflict case, people who are sincerely convinced their previous marriage was null, but they can't get an annulment because of lack of evidence, because of a tribunal mismanagement, a whole host of reasons, but they truly believe. Pope Francis is, I think, inviting bishops to a more careful discernment of cases like that. I don't think he's in any text in the document throwing the door open to full sacramental participation mm-hmm. for anyone who is in a second civil marriage. Well, although there are some people who read the document that way.
Yeah. Well, looking at sort of the totality of this pontificate, you make a very interesting observation that he looks at the family in light of the new evangelization. Let's go back to that just briefly, because you have a great line here that the signature document of this pontificate is neither Amoris Laetitia nor Laudato Si, or the care of our common home. It's Evangelii Gaudium. And then you stress that the focus of evangelization places him in complete continuity with his predecessors. Explain that a little bit more, because I think some people need to understand sort of Francis's wider vision and fit Amoris into that.
Sure. I mean, I think Pope Francis is really all in on the new evangelization and is inviting the rest of the church to be all in with him. So why have two synods on family? In order to invite families to take the lead in the church's ministry to other families, to accompany other families. So families are meant to be not just objects of evangelization, but active subjects. And again, to place evangelization at the center of the church's life, this is what Pope Benedict did at the beginning of his encyclical Deus Caritas Est. Christianity isn't about a set of ideas. It's about an event, an encounter with a person. St. John Paul II commenting on the encounter between Jesus and the rich young man in Matthew 19 in Veritatis Splendor says, the church exists to make this encounter possible. Pope Paul VI, in his document on evangelization, said the very essence of the church, her nature, is to evangelize. So Pope Francis is absolutely teaching in continuity with his three major predecessors. He's clearly in Amoris Laetitia, when we read it in light of Evangelii Gaudium, he's saying we need to think about family and ministry to family in light of evangelization. We need to equip and invite families to be part of this effort, the new evangelization. It's not just for religious, for monks, for bishops. Everyone in the church is called to be a missionary disciple, including lay people and including families.
So, Dr. Grabowski, as we kind of draw this segment to a close, I really do feel like I want to ask you one more question, and it may prolong our segment, and that's fine. But the question really is, where do we go from here? Because as you said, others have interpreted this differently. They have interpreted a change, and even some bishops' conferences have interpreted more of a change, more of an opening of the door to let divorced and remarried to receive communion, and that's disturbing to many people. So where do we go from this moment, which seems a very polarized moment?
I do agree, and I think, we have different readings of the document, not just by theologians, but by bishops and by bishops' conferences, as Matthew points out in his piece, and I think that's true, and I think that's unfortunate. Because, yes, Pope Francis clearly, he told us at the Synod that he thinks synodality is a way to promote, this is John Paul II's phrase, a healthy decentralization within the Church. But I think there's clearly such thing as too much decentralization. Mm-hmm. And the danger becomes that if we have very different practices and very different articulations of the faith in different regions or different dioceses, that then the Catholicity of the Church, our unity in faith, in worship, in practice, starts to be undercut and eroded. So I do think, Pope Francis, I think, is clear, can live with a certain amount of ambiguity and thinks that the Holy Spirit can even work through that.
Sure.
And that's why we need ongoing synodality discernment. But I do think, you know, we've got to find the virtuous mean here of how do we maintain Catholicity in the midst of perhaps clearly he doesn't want diversity of doctrine. Right.
Right. He said
so. But how do we have a Catholicity of practice, even if there's some local variation in practice?
Right.
We don't have an answer to that.
Well, we're in the middle of that mess, and I don't mean that in the most negative sense of the word, but it is a mess that we're trying to sort out as a church, and it deserves our prayers. And go ahead. I'm sorry.
And maybe a statement like Cardinal Wuerl's statement on the pastoral implications of Amoris Laetitia could be a kind of a consensus approach to help the Church find that balance and start to move forward together.
As well as look at the full document. So that is
absolutely.
That's a great point.
Let's look at more than just Chapter 8.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Dr. Grabowski, for being with us today. We appreciate your wisdom and your writing for the Register.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.